Basically, today we are going to interact from where we left last time, and we also want to welcome the office of the AG. The reason why we called AG, we wanted them to come and interact with the strategic plan of the department and also their APPs. In the last meeting we had with the department, there were some concerns from the committee regarding the strategic plan, and we requested them to hold on because of time constraints. Today they will come and clarify issues in today's meeting. Without wasting much time, I would like to request the secretary to give us apologies if there are any.
The apology is part of the joint pending judicial to the commission. Mr. Huang Kwa would like to join us today as a part of commitment. Mr. Sims was a portfolio commission communication. Ms. Van Dam also took an apology, and Ms. Malrone will be in the central office. We'll be sharing the show.
Thank you very much, Sir Sri. We will now request the office of the AG to take us through their observation in relation to the strategic plan APPs of the department. Over to AG.
Good morning, Chair and Committee, Honourable Members. Thank you for the opportunity to present to you today what we found in terms of the Department of Public Enterprises annual performance plan for 2013-16. I'm Sajon Subic, a Senior Manager in the Office of the Auditor General. Join me on the right is the Audit Manager, Walid Omar, which is the Audit Manager on the Department of Public Enterprises, and then Bernadette Kedu, you might be familiar with, as a parliamentary officer. Our presentation today is based on the request that we received. We have reviewed the previous presentation that was given to the committee on this matter. Firstly, I would just like to share our constitutional mandate. As the Auditor General of South Africa, we've got a constitutional mandate as the Supreme Audit Institution of South Africa, which exists to strengthen our country's democracy, enabling oversight, which I think is what we're trying to achieve today through this committee, accountability and governance in the public sector through auditing and thereby building public confidence. And that is our promise that we want to make to the committee and what we're trying to achieve today. Our presentation today, you'll see, is a couple of things, and it's mainly divided into three broad categories. Some of them I'm going to discuss, and some of them my colleague is going to discuss. If you see on the board, there's six items, but it's basically broken up in three parts. The first part is just a bit of background on what is our scope and mandate as Auditor General in terms of the APP of the department. Then we're going to reflect on what we found with regards to the APP for 2015-16 of the department, because there's a special or a specific scope that we look at. And then lastly, we're going to look at what we expect as the Auditor General with this committee's oversight responsibilities with regards to the strategic plan and APP of the department. Not taking much time on the agenda, background is that, as you know, the Auditor General has a mandate to perform mandatory audits, and then there's also discretion audits. And the reason why we discuss this point is it's quite important, and I'm going to emphasize five if you are following me on the side, is that the audit of predetermined objectives, which is basically the APP of the department, is part of our mandatory audits, which we do on a yearly basis. The discretionary audit would be something like a performance audit where we would audit a team which is agreed between parties. Mandatory audits would include a normal audit on the financial statements, compliance with laws and regulations, and lastly, with the performance against predetermined objectives. And I'll give you this legislative framework why we do that, which is what we would report roundabout in usually in September, October to this committee. As you would recall, last year in October we presented the audit outcomes of this portfolio we would include reflections on how the entities and the departments performed against the predetermined objectives. However, the scope for what we're dealing with today is a bit different because, as you know, an auditor actually audits historical information. I think that has already been approved, completed, reported, and we give credibility to that. What we realized with the predetermined objectives is that we can add a bit more value in the fact that we would have a view on the ATP before it is finally approved through the processes that it is going through now, to give the committee a heads up of what to look for, and if there's any material significant issues, we report it now so that it's considered before it is approved, so that we don't just work a reporting item which is on historical information alone. So that is the whole rationale for looking at the 2015-16 APT, and it's not actually part of the mandatory scope requirements that we do. This is something that we want to do in addition to provide the committee a bit more insight before they actually do their oversight. Slide 6 just explains what we term clean administration, which I think the department is proud to have that accolade in their cupboard as a clean audit. And what we're saying is that if you have an unqualified audit opinion on your financial statements, no material or significant findings on laws and regulations, and no material findings on predetermined objectives, we term that as a clean administration and an organization that operates on a basis that is required in the public sector legislation. So in effort to achieve that, we want to then contribute to what we're doing today to give you our reflections of the APP before it is actually set in stone and then reported on. Going to slide 7, so what we do on a yearly basis is that we would then report in our audit report on the three subjects that I mentioned. It is firstly on laws and regulations with regards, and I'm specifically now dealing with predetermined objectives, with regards to the laws and regulations of what is expected in legislation with regards to the APP, the strategic plan of the department. Similarly so with entities obviously as well. The usefulness, and we'll get to what do we mean by usefulness of predetermined objectives, and then lastly the reliability of the information that is reported. That is what we report on an annual basis in terms of the mandatory requirements. Where do we get our mandate to do, just to clarify? As you know, we've got a Public Audit Act, which provides for what is our responsibilities as the Auditor General of South Africa. And as you can see in the slide 8, is that we are required to audit the predetermined objectives and provide an audit opinion or conclusion on the entity's achievement of the predetermined objectives against certain criteria, which we will then get to later on. This is applicable to all spheres of government, so it stretches right down from departments, public entities, constitutional institutions, municipalities, and municipal entities, and so forth. So, in terms of the legislative framework for the entities and departments, what do they report against? And I'm currently on slide 10, as you can see on the screen there. Firstly, in our environment that we're sitting in today, it's obviously driven by the Public Finance Management Act. So there's certain requirements that the PFMA sets for a department to report or include. Further, it is clarified through the Treasury regulations, as you know. Then there are certain guidelines that is issued by National Treasury that specifically addresses the requirements in terms of reporting and when those reports need to be issued to the executive. And then there's two frameworks currently issued by National Treasury. The first one is the National Treasury Framework for Managing Program Performance Information. That is an older one, and it's still applicable, and it's applicable to the larger part of the public sector. And then there's the second one that was issued more recently in 2010, which is the National Treasury Framework for Strategic Plans and Performance Plan, which informs the part that we are sitting with today. And that's what we will then audit the department's strategic plan and annual performance plan against. So basically these legislative frameworks set out the criteria that we would audit against. And in these frameworks specifically, it talks about the usefulness and the reliability of information that is included in the department's strategic plan and performance, annual performance plan. Slide 11, I'm going to, as you know, this is a copy from what is in the framework. I'm not going to deal with this slide now because we have a slide later on which is exactly the same information, but we're going to go through the process of what we expect in the committee to do in terms of this process that you see on slide 11. On slide 12, what we're talking about here is we're going in a bit more depth in terms of what is the actual legislative requirement. So if you look at the Treasury regulations, which is issued in terms of the PFMA, in chapter 5 it talks specifically to the requirements for the department. So there needs to be a strategic plan that is initiated by the department on an annual basis. Then it also talks to public entities in terms of chapter 29 and 30. And then in terms of the public service regulations, there's also a requirement that is applicable to the department itself and not to public entities, specifically to departments. So those would be the specific legislation that we would then refer to when we do our assessment on compliance laws and regulations regarding key determinants of access. Coming to reporting requirements, there are certain requirements in terms of the PSMA on slide 13. In section 40, there's the reporting requirements that the department has, and then in section 55, there's certain requirements in terms of what the public entity needs to report on an annual basis. Similarly, so it is clarified further in the Treasury regulations, chapter 18, 28, and then also the public service regulations, as referred to in the slide. I'm not going to go in detail because these are things that obviously have not changed recently, but it is important to just set a basis from where you're working from for the committee. I'm going to hand over now to my colleague, Walid. We're going to a bit more detail in terms of what our processes then is from this firm.
Thanks, Sarah, to honourable chairperson, honourable members and staff of the department. In terms of what we look at, first of all, is whether or not annual performance report is submitted timely on 31st of May. Now that will have to be submitted together with annual reports, financial statements as well. So this generally is complied with by the department. So on certain occasions we do try and sort of last minute adjustments and or an annual report which is devoid of the annual performance reports, which often is or sometimes happens. Next slide, we talk about the key accountability documents and how it operates. The strategic plan, which is item number one, will inform an annual performance plan. That in turn informs a budget, so an expenditure which is linked to your strategic objectives and performance indicators for the program. Quarterly performance reports are then prepared from in terms of the annual performance plan. And these inform your performance agreements. So performance agreements are then assessed based on the performance in the quarterly performance reports. And remuneration or rewards are accordingly awarded according to your performance. Finally, an annual performance report is a roll-up of your quarterly performance reports. It's an aggregation of those four. And this is what is published in the annual report and submitted to us on 31st of May. And then you revisit the strategic plan when it is time provision based on your outcomes from the previous years and based on the results from in the annual performance report. Going to the next slide, we talk about the characteristics of good performance indicators. Now, there are six characteristics in total, and this is all important in terms of the framework for managing the program performance information and measuring performance information. And what we have here is reliability. A good performance indicator will have to be reliable. That is, that it is accurate enough for its intended use and response to any changes externally or internally. So we'll be able to look at an indicator and be able to look at supporting documentation, supporting processes to be able to rely on the indicator itself. It should be well defined. So in other words, the indicator should be unambiguous and it should be clear. There should not be, two people should not be arriving at a different conclusion about what an indicator represents. It should be unambiguous. Should be verifiable. In other words, you should be able to trace the indicator back to a process or back to supporting documentation. And in other words, it shouldn't be such that you can't verify what the indicator is reporting. It should be cost-effective. In other words, the usefulness of the indicator must justify the cost of collecting its data on which it is being reported. It should be appropriate and relevant. In other words, it should be related specifically to the institution's mandate. We go to the next slide. We talk about performance targets. And performance targets, again, should be SMART. And this is the criteria that is published within the framework. SMART specific, being the required level of performance should be clearly identifiable. It should be measurable. The required performance should be measurable. In other words, you should be able to measure the subject matter reported in your annual performance report. It should be achievable, so it should be realistic. It shouldn't be unrealistic. Your target set should be achievable by the department within each sub-program. It should be relevant as well. In other words, it should pertain to a specific strategic objective or within the mandate of the department. And of course, it should be timely. You should be able to achieve it within a certain time period, but there shouldn't be indefinite time periods in which you should achieve this target. Okay, then we'll talk about the actual audit process. So from 2004 to 2009, the audit strategy for performance information was very much based on a factual findings model. So we looked at the findings, whether there was anything on compliance laws and regulations, usefulness and reliability, and we reported it factually. There was no opinion or conclusion expressed in either the management reports or audit report documents. We then had interactions with key stakeholders, such as the National Treasury, Presidency, which is now the DME, as well as the DPSA, to determine and test the audit approach. So in other words, to refine the audit approach. And these inputs were then adopted in terms of the framework for energy program performance information. Subsequent to that, from 2009 to date, the phased approach was completed. And the result is that we, as an organization, as well as the key stakeholders, decided to express a conclusion on the positive performance information as opposed to factual findings expression. And this conclusion is reported in the management report for all state institutions. And the audit report itself, which is the document in any report, will only include material audit findings, not the conclusion on the positive performance information as yet. Okay, the criteria that we audit against, the main criteria is the same as outlined within is compliance with laws and regulations, usefulness and reliability. Now within usefulness, we look at specific sub-criteria in these presentations, measurability, relevance and consistency. Under reliability, which is where we actually test the data, which is reported for validity, accuracy, completeness. This is where the legwork is done. In terms of obtaining supporting documentation or obtaining verbal documentation, if that is the case, and tracing it back to the samples that we select, we perform and test against what is reported. So that is where the actual legwork is. The usefulness aspect is something that can be done prior to receiving the annual report. It can be used, or it can be achieved through looking at quarterly reports, for example, because there should be consistency between quarterly reports and the final annual report. It has to be. There cannot be major changes at this stage. The audit approach would be, first of all, to understand and test the process and the performance management process. So we consider whether or not the controls are in place to be able to collect and to plan, collect, and then report performance information. We then test the measurability, relevance, presentation, consistency of planned and reported performance information. This is what I talked about in terms of the usefulness of performance information. It should be done at an interim stage. Third, we conclude on the usefulness of the reported performance information for selected programs or objectives. And maybe I should just say at this point is we do not test the entire, we don't not test all the programs. We test what is considered as material programs. So much like the financial audit, we do not test everything. We are entitled to use samples as a representation of the population. So we would select the key or significant programs. And those can be quantitatively material or quantitatively material. In terms of how much expenditure it solves or how significant it is in terms of your national policy. Number four, we test the reported performance information against the source documentation. This is the reliability phase of it. And then finally, we conclude on the reliability of your reported performance information. Finally, in terms of reporting, the management report, which is presented to management, and is only released to committees such as yourselves once annual report is published. We then report or we conclude on the usefulness and viability aspects on performance information.
finally, the auditor's report, as we've mentioned, under the heading reports and other legal and regulatory requirements, which is a separate section on the audit reports, he would then report on the usefulness and reliability, but specifically on material audit findings on presentation, consistency, relevance, and measurability, as well as the reliability of the report and information. Finally, the compliance aspect as well. So, for instance, your submission dates, your compliance with presentation, and so on and so forth. Roles and responsibilities? Okay, in terms of the framework for managing appropriate performance information, effective management of performance information requires clear understanding of responsibilities. Now, as you can see in the table that's on the slide, there are different stakeholders in this process, and the ministers or MECs, the principals, are basically there to ensure that the institutions are set up with appropriate performance information system system, so that the objective of performance reporting is achieved. The accounting officer, the director general in this case, assisted by chief information officer, but I would imagine this for the source of the SEM meetings as well, you know, specific to the Department of Public Enterprises, would be accountable for establishing and maintaining a system to manage the performance information. The line managers, which is the people who are responsible for establishing and maintaining performance information processes and systems within their areas of responsibility, that is basically across the organization. And of course other officials which support the line managers are responsible for capturing, collecting, and then finally checking, verifying performance data that is collected in the course. If we just flip to the next slide, we talk about the understanding and monitoring of the accounting officer's mandates in terms of approving internal control environment. The role of the accounting officer in this respect would be to ensure robust financial and performance management systems. So, what was critical here is just to focus on efficient and transparent systems, financial and risk management, internal controls, as well as procurement and evaluation. In terms of the oversight and accountability function of the accounting officer, looking at effective, efficient, economic, and transparent use of resources. Looking also at prevention of unauthorized, irregular, fruitless, and wasteful expenditure. And then, obviously, if discovered, reporting to relevant stakeholders. And then, efficient economic management of available working capital. So, that is related to payables and so on and so forth. And then, finally, commitments to ethical behavior. That is to manage and safeguard the assets and liabilities of the department or state institution. And, of course, take appropriate disciplinary steps against any officials contravening the PFMA. And this links back to the previous table, which talks about prevention of unauthorized, irregular, and fruitless flexible expenditure. But including that would be disciplinary action as well, where necessary. Okay, the role of internal audit is quite critical and is increasingly important in the state institutions. And the role in terms of PFMA would be to monitor the internal controls relating to performance information processes, not just financial information. It would be to examine usefulness and reliability of performance information. So, for instance, to check court reports, just to see whether its integrity is appropriate, whether the information reported is in terms of source documentation. Also, to review critical performance management activities. So, as an example, to ensure that performance agreements of senior management services members are signed and that it's aligned, for instance, to a strategic plan and annual performance plan. To review compliance laws and regulations relating to performance planning, management, and reporting, as well as risk management activities as well. This is all sort of set out in the Treasury regulations for departments as well as public entities. Okay, in terms of support oversight, we look at the different levels of assurance and the different levels of assurance for all stakeholders in a state institution. Management is the first line of assurance, the first line of defense, as it were. This includes your senior management, the director general, as well as the executive director, the minister. And the level of assurance that one would expect from this line, this level of assurance providers would be explicit. So in terms of senior management, their role and responsibility in this regard would be to take immediate action to address specific recommendations and the financial management and internal controls. The role of the accounting officer in this respect would be to hold officials accountable who do not follow the above, and of course report quarterly and annually. The role of the executive authority in this regard would be to monitor the progress and performance, to enforce accountability and consequences for the above too. Second level assurance is your coordinating monitoring institutions, internal audits as well as the audits committee. Required assurance value would be extended, and the oversight assurance role would include National Treasury as well as DPSA, which would be to monitor compliance with specific laws and regulations and to enforce appropriate action. Internal audit, we've mentioned it in the previous slide, would be to follow up and manage infections, to address any specific recommendations, and conduct own audits to focus on key focus areas and risk areas. The work committee would then in turn be to monitor risks and implementation of commitments on any corrective action made by management, as well as quarterly progress and action plan implementation. The third level of assurance, final level of assurance, would be from the oversight program governance processes, excluding the audit committee. That would include the portfolio committee, any public accounts committee, as well as the National Assembly. The oversight committee or portfolio committee would be to review and monitor quarterly progress in the implementation of action plans. Public accounts committee will be, for instance, look to examine expenditure, for example. That would be a specific function of a oversight committee, another public accounts committee. National Assembly will then provide oversight on the reliability, accuracy, and credibility of national and international policies. We're now going to take you through the interim review, the results of the interim review of the 2015-16 annual performance plan for the department. If I can just sort of paint an overview of what the objective of this assignment was, is to determine primarily the usefulness of your strategic plan and your annual performance plan for 2015. And as we've indicated before, the criteria or the scope of usefulness would be to set the presentation consistency, the key performance indicators and targets. In terms of presentation, we're looking to see whether it's compiled in terms of the framework. In terms of consistency, we are trying to ensure or verify whether or not your objectives in terms of the ABP indicators and targets are consistent with your strategic plans, objectives, indicators and targets. In terms of key performance indicators, we're looking to see whether they're well defined as well as verifiable. And in terms of its targets, we're looking specifically at whether they are specific, measurable and time, so that whether they're being smart criteria. So the findings from the review of the 2015-16 annual performance plan was similar in nature to what was identified by the portfolio committee. In terms of the annual performance plan, however, we did not identify any significant findings on that. So I can just take you through to the next slide, which talks about other additional matters, which we are not reported as significant findings, but are just of interest, and I think would be of interest to stakeholders. Is the timing of the submissions by the departments to the stakeholders. And the first draft to the residency, as well as National Treasury, was required to be submitted on the
30th.
Sorry, this is an additional slide, the members. We did not include it in the presentation. We put it up on the other projector. We wanted this. So we were required, the department was required to submit it to the residency as well as National on the 31st of August. The actual submission date is the 17th of September 2014. The second draft was not provided at all, and just for reasons we understand it was required because the first draft was sufficient. The final draft submitted to AG for review was required to be done on the 31st of January of this year. It was only made to us on the 25th of March of this year. And finally, the APP was presented to the portfolio committee on the 24th of March, which is quite early on the 11th of March. I will also add as a proviso that the department did get permission for an extension to submit these documents to the relevant role players and stakeholders.
Thank you, Walid. I think the last part is really where we really want to delve into what we expect the committee to do and how we want the committee to transform the information that we provided in the slides up until now into the actions of today and then beyond today. And it was relevant and necessary for us to go through the slides to get to this point where we are today. As a norm, what we expected, obviously this portfolio is a very relevant portfolio, and especially in terms of the service delivery that is expected by the citizens out there. so much so that we can feel what the impact it has on our daily lives. So this is a very important process that this committee is tasked with. But what we've seen in the past, and that's why we wanted to explain the process, is that in terms of the legislative requirements and the usefulness and reliability of information, this portfolio has performed quite well. If I take you back to our presentation that we did last in October in terms of the audit outcomes of 2013-14, the portfolio together with the department has complied with all of the requirements. So we didn't expect any major findings in terms of the annual performance plan for 15-16, which obviously has been translated into what we report today. But what is important is obviously to ask the right questions at this point in time to make sure that what is included going forward is relevant in terms of what is required from the policy requirements from the policy sectors. So if I go to the next slide, which I said I will come back later on, is where we look at the oversight model. So if we look at the model, it's a fairly simple model, but it can be complicated by certain processes that happen. Firstly, we obviously see that there's a policy development from Parliament, which in our view would be the National Development Plan. That would be the first document that sets the tone. Then there's obviously the midterm strategic framework with the midterm expenditure framework, together with that and the outcomes, the 12 outcomes of government. So as an audit office, we get an understanding of those documents and we then see whether those documents inform what then happens with regards to the departments and entities in the portfolio. So that would then generally, our expectation needs to translate in what is the strategic plan and the annual performance plan for the department for a specific performance year and the 5-year period ahead. So if you see on the slide, we're at the strategic planning. So in the middle of the slide, you can see it translates into obviously the APC of the department, the shareholders' compacts, and the plans of the state of companies within this portfolio. And the expectation is obviously then we also show that the APP, the strategic plan, will also filter through to the shareholders' compacts signed with each of the state companies in this portfolio. After that, now becomes the operational planning and budgeting process, which will follow what we're going to do with today. But it informs obviously what we're going to decide in terms of what the budget and the operational planning would be. So what we then reported today is that there should be useful and specific targets and indicators that are set within this APP, which would then make sure that at the end of the day, what is done within this performance year by the department and the entities within the portfolio achieves what is required in terms of the National Development Plan and the 12 outcomes of government. And it's a very important process. After that, there would be the in-year monitoring, which would be done through the department to the executive, and then the portfolio committee can also get involved. And then at the end of this, round about September of this year, that we will then table, the departments will then table their performance against the 14-15 strategic plan and annual performance plan, which we will then report on in terms of how the report has explained. And then the accountability process begins again, where we initiate the next APP and strategic plan for the next performance cycle. So, as you can see, in terms of the oversight model, there's various stages where the portfolio committee can get involved and where we also can provide information in terms of where the department and its entities are at that stage. Secondly, in terms of the oversight component for the portfolio committee, in terms of the mandate, as you can see, the role of the portfolio committee is firstly that they should consider the legislative requirements of the portfolio, whether there is any improvements, changes that is necessary, and I think that's part of the discussion that the department will share today as well. Secondly, in terms of budget, when you do consider the budget votes after this process of initiating the annual performance plan and strategic plan, and then to look at in terms of the mandate of the portfolio and the department, whether it conforms to what is in the National Development Plan, the 12 outcomes for government and the midterm strategic framework, And then obviously to connect those accountability processes to what's promised. That is the in-year reporting that the portfolio committee we can do, and also together with the oversight when we get into the reporting cycle where there is the actual annual report that is reported to this committee and Parliament. So what we've done then in terms of as a summary for the portfolio committee is on this slide is what you should consider in regards to the APP and strategic plan. Firstly, at the top you can see those are the lines to the National Development Plan. Secondly, do you get commitments from the department whether there is adequate resources in terms of human capital and financial resources to achieve the APP? And that comes back to the achievability of those targets. Secondly, is the target realistic? Is it smart? Can you take all of those elements of the SMART principle and say whether the target achieves all of it, which we've looked at and we have given you assurance that from our point of view it does. Then to ask how would the entity or the department achieve this annual performance plan? Is there a performance contract that is being signed with the officials within the department? Is these targets and initiatives sorted through to the shareholders' compact and corporate plans of the SOCs, which is obviously the most important part of the portfolio? And then for the portfolio committee then to monitor the quarterly performance on this APP. Because it's all good well to set it at the beginning, but nothing happens in the year, and then we report on whether they have achieved it or not. And I think that is where the main other matters were in this portfolio, is that we often see that targets are not achieved as what was planned. And yes, there is certain economic environment reasons that happens during the year in this portfolio that contributes to targets not being met. But a quarterly assessment will go a long way to make sure that targets are met by the end of the year. And then at the end of the year, there's obviously to then review the annual performance or the annual performance report to ensure that targets that were set out was reported and what was the achievement on those targets, which we then also audit. A very important part of it is assessing the consistency between what is agreed today and what is then reported at the end. So this is the key steps that we would want to suggest for the portfolio committee to consider when they interact with the department on the APP and strategic plan. Lastly, as the Auditor General, we have an aspiration to be part of a public sector which is strong in its mandate. We would like to contribute, and you'll see it has the same flavor of what we said in terms of the accounting officer's responsibility to a robust financial performance management system. We want to enable oversight and accountability through what we report to this committee and to the citizen at large. We want to make sure that when there is commitments, that those ones are put through within the performance plans and that it is achieved, and whether it is not achieved, whether the appropriate consequences are taken. We want to ensure that there is ethical behavior within the public sector to make sure that what is demonstrated out there is a public sector official that is proud of being a South African. And lastly, as the Auditor General of South Africa, we would like to add value in every sense that we can compared to what we promised at the beginning in terms of our reputational promise. I thank you, Chair, for the opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you very much. AG's office, honorable members, here we are. The AG has just presented the analysis of the department strategic plans and the annual performance plans. I will now allow honorable members to interact with that presentation. You remember when we were in our last meeting with the department, the main concern was the deviation from the national treasury framework. So our discussion should focus around that, and we would like AG also to come on board and say their views clearly on these issues. Thank you. Honorable Mother and Honorable Ranto, Honorable Yenge, in that order.
Thank you, Jefferson. It'll be very short. First, I want to request a copy of the last slide that wasn't given to us. And I just want a slight answer on the following question. If I'm right, if I see that slide, that the department did submit to the deadline set for now, and that's just 1 year from now. And then thirdly, I want to know, according to your SMART targets, very interesting company, to put it that way. A department normally has like a short-term, medium-term, and long-term plan and what is what they want to actually achieve through the department. And if there's like a short-term, a medium-term, short-term is up to 12 months. A medium-term would, for example, be up to 3 months, 3 years. So if there's a target setting for 3 years, what they want to achieve, which is, that would be break down, like what should be achieved in the first 12 months for that specific target that has been set for 3 years. Because the only way it's measurable, it's been set for 12 months after 3 years to come. Otherwise, you can't measure it. And if that's taken into consideration, how do you do it or go about it? Because the long term would be 5 years. And if they, for this case, also then break up in 5 years separately, what they must achieve in the first 12 months, because this is all about 12 months period. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Tay, and let me also take the opportunity in welcoming the presentation by the department. And I will start with the last, with the question that the Honorable Marae has raised in the slide that we do not have. The retired column and the actual column, and if you put it on again, and if we are looking at it, when you first dealt with that slide, you said the first draft was retired on the 31st of August, and then the actual date is 17th September, and you, I didn't hear you mentioning or saying that the first draft, as it was expected on the 31st of August, but it was given on the 17th. I thought you were saying the required date is the 31st, but September is the actual date. That's what I actually heard you saying. But when you were talking about the last draft, the final draft, you said it was retired on the 31st of January, and the department gave it on the 21st of March, on the 25th of March, and it looked as if you are contradicting your statements, as you are saying. Is it what I have heard right, or is you still say the draft must be given on such a date, and the department has given us this date, and you still maintain that the department has a clean audit after all what has happened? You still maintain that the department has got a clean audit. You know, I always have a concern in all the departments, in all the auditor general reports that we are getting. When the auditor general says there's a time bound, speak about the SMART performance targets, and the SMART part of it, of the target are not achievable, and then the department in their approach, they've got on slide 21, they've got point number 5, a point that concludes on the reliability of the reported performance for selected program or objectives. Then the department, if that is not achieved, the auditor general has no to bite on what is not achieved by the department. You just keep quiet. You still not having penalties on people who are not giving you this, who are not performing well. You just keep quiet and leave it on us, a public representative like the MPCs, the ministers, and the councils. to just leave it as it is, you still don't have any money on doing something when the performance is not done well. Also, Chair, this also takes me to the reliability and the accurateness of the work. I apologize, Chairperson, on what I'm going to say about Limpopo. Last time I was in the NPOP, I keep on making this example. We once went to a certain municipality there in Limpopo, or a certain area where there was supposed to be a bridge. Everything was given out, the procurement, the receipts, and everything was done. But when we went to an oversight to go and look how the bridge looks like, we met an official. We were sent by the officials of the province to go to the place where the bridge is. And this official said to us, when we arrived to the place, "Hey, but this bridge was supposed to be here." And I said, "Maybe it's built in another place. Can you take us to another?" "No, no, 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 no. According to the report, it is here. But we could not find the visitor there. The Auditor General gave its opinion on the administration work that it has been given." So what I'm trying to say, if the receipts are there, but what is on the ground is not seen or it's not there, the Auditor General still keeps quiet about that. You don't have to, you don't write. If it's not there, what are you doing? Or you know, it's not your part of work, then it's somebody else's part of work. And if that report comes to your ears as the Auditor General, what is the Auditor General doing on that thing? That is why I say if reports are not given on the 31st of May, what is the penalty? Do you just give in and not give any penalties on that as a department, as the Auditor General? The other issue, your work is on general, your audit objectives, maybe they are general, but this department that you are dealing with, public enterprises, specific, is a shareholder. The core business is done by the entity. Then the department is doing an oversight on the entities, and the department gets a clean audit opinion. But the entities under the department get qualified, and the other bad things that usually are bad opinion that is given by the Auditor General. And do you still maintain that this department has a clean audit? Because the department is not the core owner of those. It does not have its fingers on the work. The work is done by the entity. And the entities are doing so bad. And it reflects bad to the department. Then what is the opinion of the Auditor General in such issues? Thank you, Chairperson. My last concern is on another concern that I usually have. Do you wait for the report of the year? You are saying you are doing an annual audit. Then you wait for the department to give you the whole report of the year, and then you make your audit. You are not allowed to intervene quarterly or in a 6-month basis to say, you see where the department is heading to. It is heading to an unqualified, and we are looking for clean opinion. And it's heading to a qualified report, in fact. Can't you
intervene and change maybe and ask the department to change the step that they are taking so that at the end of the year, what is supposed to implement and what is supposed to be done by the department, you are able to reverse it before it gets to a bad report. Thank you.
With regard to issues that have been raised in relation to the internal audit unit of the department. Well, I just wanted to check as to whether what the internal audit does in the department is similar to what AG is doing. I'm asking this, Chairperson, as a result of the ability of officials or of department to report and even report profusely on issues or aspects that do not exist, like the bridge that has been referred to. Maybe you will say it's not part of your mandate, of which we know, but is in this particular department, are there any instances where you have actually found aspects that they did not deal with accordingly and in relation to their mandate over the entities as a shareholder department? Because what you find on the entities is exactly what Honorable Rando has explained. But when it comes to the department is one of those departments that are doing very well. So their ability to produce reliable information, useful information, reliable, whatever you want, but it does not translate to what is needed or on the ground. And thirdly, Chairperson, I would want to check from AG as to whether they have sessions with the department in order to ensure that they understand their mandate as AG in preparation for the actual submission deadlines, or do they necessarily wait for them to actually get the dates within which they were supposed to have reported and then sanction or make the necessary finding? I'm referring, Chairperson, to the issue that relates to the political head of the department, the minister or the MEC, who has the responsibility to ensure that all the laws that are there that are actually informing the department as to what should happen, but that does not fall in the hands or directly in the hands of the political heads, of which the DG has a responsibility to ensure as an accounting officer of the department, which fundis of public administration would interpret a necessity of a political administrative dichotomy where the minister and DG are actually singing in one hymn. And then at the end of the day, a finding will be made by AG in relation to the production of that useful information or reliable information. So all that happens at a department like Department of Public Enterprise, with a mandate to conduct oversight over entities that are not producing very well, who then has a responsibility to ensure that those entities, in the manner in which they are operating and as against the opinions that are coming from AG, which are actually contradictory to what the department in the main is actually getting. I don't know whether I'm talking sense around this. It's a confusion. Because at some point when you get out of this, are you in that department of public affairs? Yes, you cannot over that. What is this about the load shedding and everything? But when you look at the department, what is the minister saying about this? I mean, we have also a responsibility to clarify issues as they are, as we are public representatives. Can you put us on the green light? Because what AG is doing is very important. But what AG is doing, some other time, it does not assist the real horse. The bridges will be built in papers and expenditure, but they are not there.
Thank you very much. Agent officers, I think we can respond to those questions. But before we do that, I just wanted to indicate the presentation by Mr. Strulach. Am I pronouncing correctly, Strulach? Yeah, you were saying when you were looking in the trust plan, the issues which were raised by the portfolio committee were also the issues you picked up. But you didn't say what is your opinion on those issues. And what is your opinion on these issues? And the issue of deviation, I think it should be on record to say you are fine with it. And then if you are not fine, what do we do? What are the issues the department must go and address? Because we are supposed to play an oversight role on the department and the entities, and if a trust plan before we go to the budget board is not aligned to the programs, and we okay it at this level, it's going to create complications. I wanted us to respond to all those issues, the ages of. Thank you.
Thank you, Dave, honorable members. I'll respond to the two questions. I think in terms of the last slide, I just want to make 100% sure is it the slide around the timelines. Okay. We will provide it to the secretariat of the committee. The timeline, in terms of the timelines, is what we're saying is in terms of the requirements to submit to National Treasury and the representative of the those ones were late, but they were approval provided to the executive authority for the late submission. One part I need to clarify in terms of the 31st of January requirement for the Auditor General is that it is an additional initiative from the Auditor General to look at the APP and strategic plans a year in advance in order to provide the committee and the department with a view from us in terms of the usefulness of the APP. So it is not legislated, it is a in addition requirement. So it's non-compliance. We're not going to report it as non-compliance. But we would want to see it on the 31st of January so that we have adequate time to review it and then provide this committee with the outcomes. In terms of the question around the SMART principles in relation to the time bound, whether it's short, medium, long term, yes, that would be, and that is the requirement in terms of the framework, that if you have a strategic plan, you would have to have a 5-year projection of what you indicated is. So you would have to have a target for the immediate term, and the long term. And you would have to talk to each other in terms of those sequences. So it is not specifically the scope that we're looking at now. What we are looking at now is whether the APP or the annual performance plan, whether the targets are SMART. Framework. That is what we're concluding on today. Okay. On the question around the timeline, I have spoken a bit about it now, so I think I've also clarified that. So in terms of the clean audit, based on the previous year's assessment, remember our outcome in terms of 2013-14 is based on the annual performance plan of 2013-14. The assessment we did now is on the annual performance plan of 15-16, which we still need to do the audit in future. So it will at that time be considered whether it is material non-compliance, which will impact on the clean audit evaluation or not. There was a question around the time bound and whether we as the Auditor General would report if targets are not achieved, if I understand the question correctly. And I think the concern from the member was whether we would report something around it. If a target is not achieved, it's not necessarily an audit finding, because targets might be not achieved for various reasons. It would be an audit finding, but it might not be material, would be whether those targets which is not achieved is explained in the annual performance report why it wasn't achieved. And in terms of the framework, every deviation must be explained in the annual performance report. We will look at the annual performance report and say, why is it explained why it was not met? What we can do in the audit report, if there is a majority of the targets that is not met, we can then emphasize on it in our report to say that the majority of the targets was not met. And that would be then included in our audit report. And then that would be reported to yourself and to the citizens out there. Then there was the example about the Republic breach that was not there where it was supposed to be. In terms of performance information, yes, there is obviously target that is in some cases physical and in some cases not. So if there is targets which is physical, our audit procedures would need to include certain expectations of whether those physical achievements was met or not. So for instance, in our reliability assessment, and that would be in the normal audit, we would select a sample and then inspect whether what is reported is there or not. Whether the reporting documentation is there and if it results in something physical, we would then have to inspect it at the end of the day. So it does include procedures like that. I just want to make double sure that there's no confusion. Our current assessment that we did in terms of the annual performance plan of 2015-16 does not touch on the liability because that still needs to be reported at the end. Okay. There was a question around the date of the 1st of May. That is in the normal mandatory audits. In terms of the Public Finance Management Act, a department or entity needs to provide the Auditor General or its auditors its financial statements and annual performance report 2 months after financial year end. We will then audit it and have the opportunity 2 months to then conduct the audit, complete it and report by the end of July of a particular year. If the entity do not provide us with the annual performance plan on the 31st of May, we will report it to the accounting officer and we will escalate it to the minister at that stage in order to facilitate that you get the annual performance plan to audit. If we do not get it after that, we will report it in our audit report as a material non-compliance. And then that would be in the annual performance or annual report of an entity. In this portfolio, we haven't had that situation with the department and with its entities before. I think then there's the question around the department versus the state-owned companies. I just want to clarify in terms of our responsibility as auditors of this portfolio. We are the appointed auditors of all of these entities. In some cases, in terms of the state-owned companies, we do opt not to audit it ourselves, but we do have private sector auditors that audit those entities. But we do mandate or provide them with regulations of how they need to conduct these audits, which would be similar as how the Auditor General conduct this audit and the report on the results. So in terms of the annual performance plan or the corporate plan of a state-owned company, those ones would be audited consistently throughout the portfolio and we will report consistently throughout the portfolio. It will be based on a specific entity. So for instance, we will report on these requirements as what we explained in the presentation per entity. So for instance, we would report whether the compliance, usefulness and reliability matters were complied with in terms of a state-owned company. And then we will also do similar procedures for the department itself. At the end of the day, in our general report, we would consolidate all of this and report it to the portfolio to give a reflection of what is the status of the portfolio. And as what we reported in October last year, that in this portfolio, with the exclusion that has touched with S Express, we did not have any material findings in this portfolio on all of the entities in this portfolio and with the department. I hope I addressed the question. Then there was a question around whether we wait only for year end to audit and report on the department's performance plans and monitoring. No, we don't. We wait for only at the end of the year. I think one of the initiatives is what we're doing today is that we are looking ahead in terms of the 2015-16 annual performance plan to provide input into that. With regards to in-year reporting, we do also, if the department provides that to us, we'll report it in the interim management report to the department to ensure that whether if there is any concern that it be escalated to the correct level. And as I said in the previous year, there wasn't any material significant matters that reported, and therefore there wasn't any concerns that had to be addressed. The question around internal audit, we had the presentation, one of the slides where the internal audit is contributing to the process of ensuring that performance management is appropriately managed. I can ask my colleague for these, obviously involved in the department audit itself. Do you generally find in this portfolio that internal audit is involved in this process of auditing the performance management? What we usually require, what we rely on from internal audit, is that they would audit the in-year reporting of quarterly results. Internal auditors will look at whether the reliability of the information which is reported in the quarterly results does conform to what the supporting documentation is saying. So, and then we would, in the instances which I have, is that we do then rely on work of internal audit as the auditor general. I think what part of the question is was whether we have found any differences in relation to what internal audit would find. In this portfolio, we haven't had instances where there were material differences between what we found and what internal audit found.
Thank you very much. Just to follow from there, we did consider the work of internal audit for the first quarters of financial year 14-15, and we did look at their procedures and so forth. We follow a process in terms of the international standards of auditing where we try to whether we can determine the reliance is placed or not, that those procedures are followed. And unfortunately, in this case, because the internal audit's scope is different, they add different programs to what we focus on. As I mentioned earlier, we look at programs which absorb a lot of budget and which are material, qualitatively speaking, from a national perspective, policy perspective as well. So the compliance aspect in terms of submission, the quarterly reports, the executive authority, accounting officer, etc., were complied with in terms of so our results did not differ in that respect. But we did not rely on the work subsequent to that because the programs were not aligned to what we said.
Then there was a question around whether we have sessions with the department, and I can actually also include with the state and companies in relation to the theme of performance information. Similarly to the slides that we presented here, the first lot of slides, which is really a capacity building initiative, we have shared with the department and the state-owned companies, with each of them, and we have these type of discussions with the relevant divisions and division heads responsible for the strategic planning and reporting. So we are comfortable that the message, the requirement that is set out by legislation is understood by the people involved. I think the difficult question which was then posed as well is whether what would happen in the instances where we see something different to the ground of what is expected in terms of legislation. I think the difficulty of the subject is that performance information and the actual performance against that target and is influenced by a lot of factors in this portfolio specifically. Because you've got a portfolio that has a commercial and a developmental mandate. on the developmental mandate, it's more, it's easier to monitor because you've got targets and you are able to then set initiatives to achieve those. On the commercial front, it's very difficult because the commercial objectives is often influenced by factors outside of the control of the department and with the entities in relation to economic, international, all of those kind of factors that comes into play. So it is often what we found in this portfolio is that you would find that the commercial objectives or targets was not met in most cases because of economical factors. And those things, like I said earlier, we do, if it is material or significant in terms of the amount of objectives which is not met, we do report on it. But that is the type of factor we need to consider. And what we do audit is then to say whether if the department or the entity explains why they didn't meet or achieve the target, whether it is credible information, whether it's supported. So if they do not meet, for instance, the revenue targets on a state-owned company, we would look at the explanations given why and whether it is supported by whether those factors actually existed in the market at that point in time. I think the last two questions in terms of our presentation, we do apologize. There was the one change, well, two changes in terms of the timeline, and then there was the change in terms of the strategic plan findings. In terms of our scope, what we look at this stage, remember what I said is that this is an initiative that we do in order to give our initial views on the annual performance plan. It does not go in detail with the strategic plan at this stage because our scope was mainly focused to the performance plan. What we did note is that yes, there is a concern around the timing of the strategic plan, which was for 4 years and not 5 years, which is quite in terms of the framework. And that was the only material matter that we've noted in terms of our assessment. The implications at this stage is that the department still can't amend it because it's not set in stone as yet. And I think that's the beauty of the process that we're doing today, is to allow that process to be escalated to the right level in order to take the initiative to change. And so that we don't sit at the end of this performance here and as Auditor General we come and hit you on the with the nail and say, but you didn't do a 5-year plan. We want to contribute, that's why we're sitting here. So that's what the situation is. So there isn't any compliance deviation at this stage.
Okay, thank you very much. On that note, I think we all come to stay behind if you have some more time, but now the department will beginning to address us on the issues we raised in the last meeting relating to what you have just presented. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I think
DTIC brought so many people here today. Is there anything specific or you wanted to?
Thank you, Chair. The reason is that most of the time when we engage in the committee, we engage on specific programs. So I'll always be accompanied by a DDG, probably responsible for an ESCOM or a Transnet. Now, there are other DDGs that are doing cross-cutting functions. And so what we're discussing, the annual performance plan and the strategic plan, I felt that they needed to be here as well. Especially because we want also to talk around the kind of support that we want from the committee in terms of taking our proposal going forward. And we'll see also when we start engaging in terms of some of the questions that we asked last time around, what is the kind of stand on the table for the development of the legislation that will identify not only the role of state-owned companies in the country, but the mandate and the role of the department in oversight. So that's the reason. And in addition, Chair, we do have other businesses in Cape Town. There are other activities as well.
Yes, thank you. Are you ready? Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Morris, can they be kindly introduced? The one that we do not know for me for the first time.
Thank you, Mr. Honourable Member. I think that we do this, please, they will all introduce themselves and their areas of responsibility.
Good morning, Chairperson and Honourable Members. My name is Sindala Mufukeng. I'm the Acting CFO.
Good morning, Honourable Members and colleagues. My name is Tuna Saliba. I'm responsible for strategy.
Good morning, Honourable Members and colleagues. My name is Nikki Mbono. I'm the Deputy Responsible for Economic Impact and Policy Alignment.
Good morning, Honourable Members. My name is Khoso Mdise, Deputy Responsible for Transport Enterprises.
Good morning, Chair. Good morning, Honourable Members. Please, my name is Jackie Mdise, and I'm the EDG Responsible for Strategic Partnerships.
Good morning, Chairperson. My name is Philip. I'm the Head of the Office of Deputy Minister.
Good morning,
okay, as we know the basis and the links, that was an important exercise, and the actings are about five. Okay, yeah. We need to move with speed. Okay, let's proceed with the business. Who's taking us through, Jenny? Yes, she's on the acting. Take us through, Jenny.
Thank you, and Honourable Members. Because we did present the last time, what I want to do, I just want to flash again a couple of slides, probably to be two slides, based on the discussion with AG, so that I just bring the two discussions together in terms of aligning. This slide talks to the slide, the AD slide, is not numbered, but I think members will remember this one. Because why this is important for us is that AG is saying to the committee, when we come back as a department the next time, this is the kind of a matrix that you need to put in terms of asking questions and checking whether we are complying in terms of the framework. So, firstly, APA, the APP and the strategic document must align with the regional development plan. And I think this last chair talks exactly to that. You recall last time we indicated that we have what you call the relative government or cabinet, and it defines policies, case that policy has been defined as the NDP 2010 to 2030. There is the content of the NDP, they are further categorized into the MTSF. Which is the 5-year period of 2014 to 2019. So on the first step, aligning with the NDP, we are saying we are already on track.
in terms of our both our APP and our strategic document. And even cascading it down in terms of our operational plans and our annual performance plans, there's that kind of compliance. Then there's the issue that then AG alluded to in terms of relationships between the department and the state-owned companies and other government departments. And that, in our strategy, we also are highlighting those in terms of collaboration. Collaboration between DPP and other government departments, whether being policy departments, the regulators, the departments that are responsible for direct service delivery for which the state-owned companies will support, and as well as the president. There is also collaboration between the state-owned companies within the portfolio itself, and collaboration with the state-owned companies within the portfolio and those that are outside the portfolio. Then, of course, then the role of the department in terms of oversight. Now, Chair, I think it is important also to remind the committee and colleagues here that the department currently is responsible for 6 state-owned companies. So, sometimes it pains us when the challenges that we are facing in ESCOM are seen as a reflection of the entire, or the performance of the entire portfolio. So we also want to remind that we currently have one state-owned company, ESCOM, that is facing serious, serious, serious challenges. The others, they are those that are doing well, they are those that can migrate to problems, but overall, we would say average the performance of the portfolio is not a political mirror against the performance of ESCOM. So I thought this slide is important today. We are aligned in terms of what the AG is requesting the portfolio committee to look at in terms of monitoring our performance. Then this slide again talks to the previous slide and the slide of the AG to say. And later to address this slide is also to address the question that was asked to the AG that is the department deviating from the requirement in terms of this strategic document. The deviation is in respect of a template. But if you look at the provisions of Treasury Regulation 5 that says what the content of a strategic document should be, everything that is in our strategic document is covered, and even the APP. So in terms of the work that needs to be done in terms of, and complying with what the PFMA says as the minimum requirements of an APP and a strategic document, we have not deviated from those. Where we have deviated is template, and it's also because we say if you look at the provision of the PSMA itself in terms of requirements of the state-owned companies. State-owned companies are required to submit their plans, for example, their credit plans, a month before the financial year end, which will be the end of FEBS. And when you look at the requirements in terms of government departments, in terms of those deadlines that the AG has set, you have a challenge in terms of aligning the deadlines of the resources and the department. So our strategy document also tries to deal with it, so that we are also able to have a process where your mid-year result of state-owned companies, the annual report of the SOCs, the AGM cycles, the requirements in terms of concluding the shareholder compact and submission to national treasury is aligned with the requirements of what the department would like to see. So again, deadlines that if you look at all of us are regulated by the PFMA, the PFMA saying these are the deadlines for government departments, these are the deadlines for the SOCs, but you find that we are far apart in terms of alignment. So the strategy is trying to address that issue as well. I'm going to last chair because I want to ask you go to the question that you posed in the previous meeting so that we can have a discussion on those. But I just want to remind the committee again the slide that goes with the So just a reminder, Chair, to say what we have done in terms of making sure that we you would be able to monitor our performance separately for the state-owned companies, because again that question was asked earlier into to the AG, is that we have identified what we call 10 challenges and risks that can materialize if the department is not putting measures in place to ensure that the SOCs achieve and or avert the federal crisis. So around as Colton saying, we have identified that we currently have a tense situation of continued load shedding. And if we don't monitor and manage that situation carefully, we can move to a countrywide blackout. Now, you've seen that as of yesterday, late yesterday, we moved into stage three. And the reason for that as well is that you have moved to that stage to make sure that you don't go into a blackout. But there are sensitivities now that, you know, the question is being asked, and I've been seeing the media as well this morning say, if you are able to move to stage three, what is it that can prevent stage four, that can prevent a blackout? So already in our strategy, we're dealing with those things. You see, we're forward looking to say, we already addressed the issues of the unrest in Maiduguri, because partly is that if you don't deal with those things, you add further to already a constraint system, but also you increase the chances of further delays to build program. Issues of how do we ensure that we have the better credit, the downside. So that will be the way that, from the shareholder perspective, what are the measures that we're putting in place to ensure that we address this, from both of the sovereign and for state-owned companies. However, one needs to put a caveat here and think some of the circumstances would be things that are outside our control. So we're also putting we're opening our eyes wider in terms of exogenous factors, and to be able to see how do we relate to those. Collapse on government guarantees. We believe that is a role that we, as a shareholder, we can improve on. But it's also minimizing, first and foremost, the reliance of state-owned companies on guarantees. And then say, where there are guarantees, how do we make sure that they cannot be triggered so that they can, the state will be required to pay up. The issues of transport in terms of reliance on road transportation, and this also talks to the collaboration, because already there's a process and also an agreement, and this is also embedded in Minister's Performance Agreement with President on the road to re-migration, and it involves both as common transport. So I wanted to say, Chair, the AG spoke about smart targets, measurability and reliability, and things that would fit easily in terms of those issues that the AG alludes to. Then in terms of getting into the discussion, then Chair, there were a number of questions that were posed to us the last time, and the colleagues who assist me in terms of them engaging with the committee on, but there was a question around the process, how far is the department with the process on the government shareholder management model and the bill, and that I would leave to the team DDG legal to talk to. The SOC social contribution, there was an issue raised, and it was a specific reference that was made to staff call and around the social contributions, so I would allow the DDG manufacturing to talk to those issues. Issues of triple BEE for both ESCOM and Transnet, especially there was an issue around Transnet performance of 94%, but I remember the concern from the committee member was that there seemed to be a low contribution to empowerment by the Transnet. So the DG Transport will talk to that. The issue of the SOC being heavily geared in terms of reliance on debt, what is the department's intention there? I would allow the DPG responsible for strategic partnerships and funding to talk about what we mean as the department is needed, and also to talk to the other sector participation framework in order to attract other sectors. Then on what is the department doing to address the constraints that are created by the budget? This was raised in light of when we were facing that the allocations we've been given around about 268 million, and the bulk of it 350 on program one. So I would allow the acting CFO, assisted by the acting DDG responsible for forest management, to talk to me on what we are trying to do to make sure that we sort the assets that we have. Then there was a question around, over and above the strategy, what is it that we are doing as the department to turn things around? And an example they was given of Eskom that seems to be getting worse. Are we looking at bringing in external resources to assist in terms of capacity control? The director responsible for strategy will talk to us. And then consequence management for SOC non-performance. I'll ask Brina to talk to that as well. And then establishment of partnerships as a measure to assist us to measure the SOC the target. I think DDG strategic partnerships will talk to that when he addressed. Then there was an issue of the balancing of the commercial mandate and the developmental mandate, our contribution to empowerment, skills development, DDG responsible for economic impact and policy alignment to talk to this. So, Chair, those are the questions that were asked. I'm not sure if there's others that today the members would like to engage, or we should go through those ones, and then Chair can take the new set of questions.
Yeah, I think let's proceed and have responses from the relevant responsible DGs, and then members will need to follow up after that.
How far the department is on the GSM bill. I can report that the GSM bill, as you probably know, has long been developed, probably, or drafted, probably around 2009-2010. We do have a draft bill, but because of the recent development, the PRC recommendations and the cabinet report resolutions of January this year, we need to align the bill with the recommendations. Of key importance is that the coming from the PRC recommendations, that the department needs to establish an overarching legislation, also determine an appropriate shareholder management model. I think one of the questions also that we, just as the DG saying, we couldn't answer because of time constraint last time, was that what is wrong with the current, is there something wrong with the current model? As you would know, there are various models, the centralized model, the decentralized model, and probably a hybrid model. So where we are at the moment, we're waiting on the GSM bill to take into consideration what is the appropriate model. And that entails also going back and doing the benchmarking exercise. And also, we are consulting with our various departments, National Treasury, EDD, DTI, and various departments also that have got big owned companies are reporting to them. So we're consulting so that we can be able to determine that appropriate model. And also what we're looking at is also the classification of SOC in order to determine the strategic nature of those SOC, where they can, what conditions are they made to the economy. So work that has already been done needs to be brought back into the GSMB, for example, the board appointments methodology, the remuneration standards. So we are meeting as departments in various fora. For example, under the IEC that was established from Cabinet Lokota, there is the DG Forum which met on the 31st of March, I think, in order to consolidate all various mandates that are coming from Cabinet Lokota. So we've got a very aggressive project plan in terms of how we want to proceed with the bill. But looking at the work that needs to be done, we're looking at probably having the draft that should be presented to Kenya probably in February 2016 in terms of the time frame that we have. But before that, there needs to be a concept paper, a white paper that we are envisaging to bring back to Parliament within the remaining months.
Before we proceed, in line with what you have just said, you are aligning the resolutions of Cabinet Lokota and also the PRC. For in the sake, who is supposed to implement the recommendations of the PRC? Is it the Cabinet or the Presidency?
In matter of fact, it's the presidency, but we're working hand in glove with the presidency because the department having some peers the GSM bill, we were still responsible, but taking the lead from the presidency, we're still be responsible for coordinating all these activities. Hence, I said maybe below the IMC that was formed, there's the DG forum that our acting DG is leading in terms of coordinating all the various activities that we should take place in driving the process forward.
Thank you, Chair. With regards to the question on budget constraints and basically how we have a budget of 250 but managing 700 billion state-owned entities, what we have started to do, especially in this new financial year, is basically to try and align the Program 3 and Program 2, which is the core sectors, and also legal and governance, which is also in charge of the legislation. So trying to capacitate those programs and taking, not necessarily taking away resources, but looking at the resources that are in Program 1, whether they can be utilized in core business in order to ensure that the strategy is achieved, but also that we are making a meaningful impact in terms of our SOC. So from a finance perspective, we are in the process of finalizing the demand plan together to do the procurement plan for the department, but mainly focusing on those targets that are on the APP and basically the targets that will ensure the achievement of the strategic objectives that set out in the presentation and also addressing the risks that have been outlined in the strategy. So we are in the process. We are hoping to finalize the process by mid-June, so that by the time we do the adjustment estimate, which is in August, we would be able to shift the funds that we need to shift to Program 3, and also making sure that we reduce the financial the finances within Program 1 to give it to Program 3. But I'll also ask the acting DDG corporate management to also add in terms of the human resources process.
Thanks, Chairperson and honorable members. From a corporate management point of view, Chair, we are looking at the reorganization of our structure. We're looking at three processes, including the budget. One will be the process. We're working on the business process mapping to ensure that all our processes are efficient from a fast and a quick decision-making point of view. That's what we're working on currently. And secondly, from a systems point of view, will be to automate the system to be able to analyze performance of the organization, and of course our SOCs, without going through a manual process, which sometimes makes our organization to be inefficient, and we are not responsible quickly identify challenges that are arising from the SOCs. Part of the work that we are doing is to automate our systems to be able to analyze performance of the SOCs in relation to the targets that we have been defined in the compact. And then the last area is all the structure, because we only have 227 staff establishment within DPEY, a very small organization. But what we have decided is we don't have any new vacancies that have been allocated. We will be maximally sweating the limited resources that we have. In the short term, what we have defined is to identify the current vacancies that we have, especially within corporate management, which has about 67% of the staff establishment. And yet the core units within the department only have about 33%, which we think it's an abnormal situation which we need to reverse. What we started, of the 27 vacancies that we have, we are prioritizing the core sector teams to beef up their capacity. But those vacancies within the sector teams, we expedite filling those vacancies. But in the medium to long term, Chair, we are looking at implementing a work study that will assess the competences of everyone, especially within corporate management. Those who have capabilities, I'll use the example of a CFO. If we appoint a CFO chair, we would look at how the expertise and the capabilities of the CFO to be maximally utilized. Than only focusing on the DPE finances, how can we utilize the role of the CFO to also assist the sector team in the financial analysis of the SOCs? That is what the recommendation will assist us to respond to. Also within corporate management, we have people who have qualifications that we can utilize in the sector teams. We have people who are economists within corporate management, which we think we could utilize in the sector teams. The last area, as part of the structure, will be to move from a program-specific structure that work with the matrix structure, which will allow us to be flexible in how we utilize our resources, especially our HR resources. But at the same time, we will make sure that we minimize and reduce the administration cost to be able to focus on the core business of the department. That is the first profit management point of view that we're implementing currently to support the strategy to arrive at having a strong, agile, and a flexible shareholder that will perform its money to maximum. Thanks, Chair.
Thanks, Chairperson. Just to add on the point that SNDG has raised, I think the new strategy has took us a need to reorganize and look at what we can do with the available resources. And I think that is critical, the phasing of filling of posts within Program 1 is going to give us additional resources that we can be able to utilize to capacitate the units that are highly undercapacitated, looking at the core areas such as energy, transport, and manufacturing enterprises. Furthermore, I think while we are doing that, I think the capabilities of the department need to be augmented to deal with the challenges that some of the companies in the portfolio are facing, and that will be, also be bringing in technical expertise from outside, just to help us to deal with some of the challenges and also to make sure that the work of implementing the strategy is not further delayed with some of the governance issues that we'll need to address in changing the structure of the department.
I'm responding to the question on the social contribution of SACOL. What we want to say is that SACOL has certain compact, social compact that has entered into with communities that operate or that live close to its plantations. the challenge you have is those social contacts, but they're still CSI focused. SAFCOL still builds classrooms, still builds homes for the elderly using timber frame structures and other activities, including issuing bursaries to students in this particular area. What we require, and that's what we are addressing with the new strategy that we received a month ago from SAFCOL, is to see those communities, the strategic partners of SAFCOL in those plantations, as most of those communities actually are also claiming on the land that the SAFCOL is operating on, and there's a process that is unfolding with rural development, of course, to ensure that those claims are settled. And what we want is, when those are claims are settled, SAFCOL is seen as the right partner for the communities going forward. So basically what we are saying is that there can be an improvement, of course. And the last point that we just wanted to emphasize, that SAFCOL operates mainly in Limpopo and in Mpumalanga. And they also have a small plantation in Gome in Northern KwaZulu Natal. Therefore, those social comments I've spoken about, they are in those areas because of where SAFCOL is operating from. As you all may recall, SAFCOL's plantation in Western Cape, Eastern Cape, and South of KwaZulu Natal, those were sold off between 2000 and 2004. So they did not have a national impact, if I may put that way. So it's still they're very much regionalized at this point.
Thank you, Chair. I'll be responding to the last question that was asked regarding the balancing of the commercial and the developmental mandate of the state-owned companies, and also regarding the skills contribution by the state-owned companies. On balancing the commercial and developmental mandate, the view of the department is that it's important what differentiates the state-owned companies from any private company is the developmental aspect of their mandate, but also in observing that, ensuring that at the end of the day we don't end up draining them financially completely. And so in terms of doing that, we've identified several key areas that get supported, or rather four strategic pillars that they need to respond to, and those include procurement, job creation, enterprise and supply development, and skills development. Now, we've got a transformation framework and guidance that guides those state-owned companies in terms of what is expected. But there's also the importance of differentiating between the license to operate, which forms all these key pillars that I've mentioned. But there are also issues that are not necessarily license to operate, but that are developmental initiatives that government decides on that can have very significant costs for the entities. So in those instances, as a department, we would encourage that perhaps government considers providing additional funding to assist the entities, especially those that are ailing. Over and above that, we are exploring partnerships, particularly in terms of collaboration between ourselves as the shareholder oversight department and other departments that have access to funding. I'll mention as an example, in terms of skills development, because we realize that there's focus in government to develop scarce and critical skills, and that requires, therefore, the state-owned companies training those scarce and critical skills for themselves, for their own requirements, but also for the national pool, which therefore means that they then need to get additional funding. And we've gone out and we've got a memorandum of understanding with the Department of Higher Education and Training to get additional funding through the National Skills Fund, and that is assisting in that regard. Now, we're also busy forming partnerships with other departments, such as Department of Small Business Development, so that we try and find additional funding that can help to complement their own funding that in, that comes from their own operations. Regarding the skills contribution, we are approaching that in a government-wide approach, in the sense that there are targets that are expected of the state-owned enterprises based on the accords that were reached, both with state-owned companies but also with the private sector, to say that there are still the specific number of skills that needs to be produced by a certain year, and that was a 5-year target that will be ending by 2016. And in terms of responding to that, we therefore work very closely with other departments, including Economic Development Department and Department of Higher Education and Training. So we've got a skills development forum for the state-owned company, and that ensures that with the money that gets pushed to these companies, we do get the return in terms of getting those skills into the pool. But coming with that is the issue of ensuring that once those skills are developed and people are qualified, for instance, as artisans, they don't then sit unemployed. Hence, one of the pillars that we respond to is job creation. So in that forum, we try and deal with issues holistically, where we bring in the other state-owned enterprises that are not necessarily in the portfolio, to just make sure that we find a way of getting strategies to ensure absorption of the skills that would then be developed for the national pool. And we work closely with departments such as the Department of Labor that have got the ESA system that checks how many people are required in each of the 16 skills categories that are categorized as scarce and critical, so that we then understand where the demand is and what needs to be supplied, and also identifying what can then be supplied from the state-owned companies. We're also looking into now partnerships with the private sector, because part of the strategy of the department is that which emphasizes collaboration amongst the state-owned companies, but also collaborating with their suppliers and their customers. So through those the partnerships that we are initiating to help the state-owned enterprises, we then trying to find a way to balance out that additional funding of getting the same impact of meeting what's required for the development of the country and supporting the growth that's required. And this also specifically is what's required for the strategic infrastructure programs. So we look at the demand and supply in terms of that skills development and skills contribution from that side as well, in ensuring that we don't only do so just for the national pool, but that in terms of what in terms of the skills that are important currently to support these infrastructure programs, we get to a point where we'll be able to provide some of those skills using our own labor in the country.
Thank you, Chair. Tied to the previous response is the question on the 94% achievement of Transnet with regard to the BEE, a key performance indicator, and the fact that this is contradicting figures that have been achieved for Black women and youth. And I think it is prudent to just indicate that the 94% is obviously an achievement of the wider BEE target, which would include Black women, youth, and so on and so on. So, taking into consideration the fact that we still have a lot to achieve in terms of empowering women and youth, especially Black women and youth, in respect of skills development, in respect of ensuring that Black women and youth and all of the other groups of previously disadvantaged groups are able to react or to respond to the needs of the SOCs in terms of procurement. The SOCs are actually urged through the targets that I give them to ensure that they support through the various programs that they have individually, including Transnet as well, and that the department as well has a competitive supplier development program that it coordinates with all of the SMEs to ensure that programs are put in place that would focus on upskilling those groups so that they are also able to respond to the procurement needs of the SMEs, and therefore, in time, be able to increase the achievement numbers within the total BEE targets.
Thank you, Chair, Secretary members of the committee, the two colleagues. I'm just going to respond to the two questions regarding how to do the FOC going to reduce reliance on the fiscus, and also the question of the privacy participation framework. In terms of that, what I would like to indicate is that we're looking at a number of instruments. Not only are we going to be looking at debt, but we're also going to be looking at equity. Probably just zooming onto the issue of debt, we'll not only be looking at debt in the form of bond issuances that are actually issued by the FOCs on the local market, but we're also looking at the international market. And probably, just to probably indicate, in terms of those debt instruments, when you look at both Transnet and Eskom, they've been quite active in the market, both the domestic force and the international market in terms of raising funding in order to reduce reliance on the system. We'll also be looking at equity instruments, as I indicated, from institutional investors and many other investors that will actually be needed in order to bolster the balance sheet of most of these SOEs. We'll also be looking at project finance instruments in terms of the projects that the SOEs will be undertaking, actually given the mandate they've been assigned. We will also be crowding in or looking to the multilateral institutions to actually assist with the funding, because they've got a much greater rating and also have access to broader instruments that the SOC can actually tap into. When we look at in terms of the private sector participation framework, we have been working quite closely with the SOC, especially trying to see the last year, in terms of how do we really count in the private sector in terms of making sure that the infrastructure build program does in fact happen and you bring private sector partners on board. That work has actually progressed over the years. We've agreed on a framework. We will now be getting a number of PMA applications on identified projects that we've actually agreed on in terms of how this process is going to manage and how it is going to be monitored and governed going forward. So that is what one wants to probably highlight in terms of the two questions that have been indicated.
Honourable members, these were the response from the department from our previous discussions. I don't know if there are any follow-ups to the questions. Where do I start? Right? And then we'll be followed by the Honourable Mare and then Honourable Muzur. I'm going to take time to get used to the setting. Yes.
Chair, I've got a few comments to make or questions to ask. The first one is on the last response that we have got. I just want to check with the department if the department has sort of made a research on all the instruments that they are going to use for these SOCs to be viable and not to be dependent too much on the national fiscal. The instruments that you are saying that you are going to use, you have seen Transnet or what the other SOCs using some of the instruments, and they were they probably have moved on, or they probably made good results. Do you think, in your research that you have made, is it still going to work with the other SOCs that you have, and in the manner that the other SOCs are operating, because they are not operating in the same manner that the Transnet and the other SOCs, like SAX, for example, is a domestic. Is it going to help you if you use this instrument, and then how are you going to make it possible for such a SOC to work to use the instrument of that you said you look on internationally also. SAS for me is having a problem as a domestic project or domestic program. Do you think that it is going to be viable, or is it going to work for the department if you look internationally instead of correcting it here internally, and then when you see that it is developing internally, then you can look internationally. I'm worried about the instruments that you have mentioned here. I'm really worried, but I'm looking forward in seeing that if it is really going to work. To the other presenter, UDDG, who spoke about the KZN, Eastern Cape and Western Cape Eastern Cape, KZN and Western Cape, that their operations were sold off and they were not nationally. They did not have national impact. I just wanted to check what is a national impact. Come in, Lala Sheka. I might not know if yes, it's in time. And yeah, what is national impact? And if you say they did not have national impact, do you mean that they did not add value to the economy nationally? They only add value in their region where they are, and not in the national economy of the country. And the last one, Chair, is on the white paper that is coming in the next month. You know, some of the things that made us not to go forward and not to have sometimes a clear vision is to generalize this and to say this might happen, this is going to happen up in again. And what if it's not happening? Then it goes towards your target, that is the draft that you're going to give to the cabinet in November 2016. I think if you have a clear target on your white paper, then you will have a clear target on your last destination. I don't think if you don't have a clear target on the first one, you will have a clear target. That's my assumption. Maybe I might be wrong. I stand to be corrected on that one. Thank you, Chair.
Honourable Leader, it's your turn.
Thank you, Chairperson. Mine is just one shared, and it relates to the community empowerment programs in order to ensure that there are public-private partnerships with the state-owned enterprises. What effort is it there to ensure that our communities does actually rise to the occasion with the necessary skills and expertise to compete with big business according to the mandate of the different entities. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. It's not a question, it's more of a comment, and I want to go to the DGs for specific. The point that was making clear that it's actually Eskom and Transnet that has the major capital rollout plans that will directly contribute to job creation in South Africa. And our request is that in those two SOC's cases, we have to put something in place that there is monitoring on a monthly basis to monitor this capital rollout plan, what has been achieved, and how they're going forward. And that's always in, and that's also in line with the target setting. But you can see in those two cases, is there going to be a contribution to job creation? Is there going to be a contribution to economic growth in that regard? Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I've been very vocal about the bonuses and salary increases that have been paid, especially to ECOM, in light of, if you'll pardon the word, in light of the pan. In light of the motion. Unfortunately, these puns are going to come quite a lot. And I did some investigation with my researcher, and I came across something that's very interesting. Not one of the executives that earned their bonuses didn't achieve 100% of their KPIs. So in other words, they received their bonuses because they've actually achieved their key performance indicators. So that's where the problem lies. The problem lies in the fact that they were given KPIs that were so easily achievable and were so irrelevant to their actual job that keeping the lights on wasn't really one of the key performance indicators. And that according to the contract that they signed, they'd achieved the KPIs. And that's why it was almost legitimate, even though it wasn't the right thing to happen. They achieved their KPIs and they therefore achieved their bonuses. So, Chair, that's why I think that this is where DPE and our DDG step in and say, okay, hold on, there is a problem here. If the lights aren't staying on and yet people are achieving their KPIs, and are actually achieving the targets that were set for them, then we need to look at what kind of targets are being set. And we need to look at a complete overhaul of how we look at and how we hold the executives of these companies accountable. Actually, I know, I have been, when was I into departments? A week and a half ago, I had a protest outside the Department of Public Enterprises. And okay, I know that DPE is working hard to try and keep the lights on because, it's something that's of great concern and of great embarrassment to the department. But, Chair, it does worry me to the extent to which the entities seem to be going off on their own tangent and not really adhering to what DPE instructions are being given. And then when we had our meeting with Minister Rao, that worried me even more when Minister Brown explained the extent to which DPE's hands are tied because of contracts signed with and the structure of the state-owned entity and what level of intervention DPE and the Minister can actually have in these companies. So I then also realised it's very unfair to come and dump an entire skip on DPE and say this is all your fault, when DPE's hands are also very much tied in what they can do in interventions. For example, I couldn't understand why DPE and DG weren't at the DPE the day the strike started. Then I went and read the letters of corporation and documents relating to Eskom, and I realised that DPE is actually very hand-tied when it comes to strike action that happens at Eskom. So yes, they can offer advice. But sure, I think that's also fundamentally flawed in terms of the fact that DPE is the stakeholder of these companies, yet their hands are so tied in what they are able to do to rectify problems within the companies. And I think that that's something that also needs to relook, because if these companies are in fact going to be state-owned entities, then the state and the minister are going to have more accessibility and more tools made available to step in and sort the problems out. Otherwise, we're going to have continued DPE coming here saying, we've done what we can, and now the company actually has to go forward. So I think a lot of blame that we've put on DPE is actually not, it's been unfair, because they've done what they can, but according to the law, then stops here. And that's why I think that the sooner we get legislation in place, Chair, that rectifies this kind of situation, the better off will be. And then lastly, Jefferson, in a state, and I think once you reach load shedding 3D, as we received last night, there is no spin doctor in the world, no Mac Maharaj, no one, that could deny that last night we hit a national crisis. I know for a fact I had a sleepless night. I know that EG had a sleepless night. I know everyone that works closely with ESCOM had a sleepless night, because we did not know what we were going to wake up to this morning. When I woke up at 5:30 this morning and the lights went off at 6, my heart stopped, because I thought, is this now load shedding 3, or is this, are we hitting a blackout now? So this is now, you cannot spin it. It is a national crisis. And I want to know from the Department of Public Enterprise, at what point does the department say to the minister, Minister, we are here as your department, as your advisory bodies, as your DDGs, as your trusted informants. We need to inform the nation as to what's going on. We actually need to send out either a national broadcast. And it sounds extreme, it's not, because this is what the country expects. Either a national broadcast or a national presser telling the country, this is what stage 3 load shedding means. This is exactly why it's happening, because the media is sending out very mixed messages, and it's very frightening. We need absolute calm. We don't need panic, because I don't know if you saw this morning, people were rushing off to petrol stations, filling up their cars, people were buying liters of water, people are buying tins of tuna fish. It's like 1994 all over again, Jefferson, because people don't know what to expect. We've got these random people on Facebook and social media discussing the fact that this afternoon we're going to hit stage 4 load shedding. Jefferson, at the Easter weekend, I myself actually phoned the information officer of ESCOM. It wasn't Easter weekend, because it was April Fool's. If someone had sent an April Fool's Day joke out in Limpopo, saying, we're about to hit the national blackout, so go and get water, and ESCOM says the only place that won't be located is in Kandla. And people that didn't realize that it was April Fool's started sending emails to politicians saying, is this true? What is it going to take 2 weeks for the lights to come back on? And I actually phoned Eddie Loja, because he was the only person who had his cell phone number. And I said, please, ESCOM actually needs to release a statement to say that this is an April Fool's Day joke by some fool, with respect, and it is not true, and can, you know, that's the problem, G, is that the communication is so poor that it creates the sense of national panic, and then it allows people on social media and on Facebook to create this nonsense that causes this mass panic. So let me tell you, G, I was the minister. I would love my DG to phone me and say, Minister Mazzoli, in actual fact, she wouldn't call me, she would call me Tasha. She would say, Tasha, I would like very much to send out a national presser, or for you to run national TV and inform the country what the state of ESCOM is, so that there can be no uncertainty going forward. Because, Chair, stage 2 load shedding is frightening. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Those are the questions, follow-up questions from members. And I think I will allow the department to respond to that, and we'll round up.
Thank you, Chair. I think the police would answer those the questions specific to their areas. But maybe let me start where Tasha has ended. I think it's a profound point, Chair, in terms of communication. And I know that, so I take it that
I'm one of those, in this collective, one of those that deserve a bonus, because we've done exactly what you said. We've advised the minister, the department and the minister, and the war room, we're working together with TCIS on a statement. And also, I think there's one thing that we need to guard against, is that, yes, it's good to communicate, but at the same time, you must know what's communicating. Because if we want, if already this, you correct this concern, this panic. Now, if you come and talk and then with that communication, you provide more uncertainty and communication is ambiguous, you're creating more problems. So I think we've advised that we are working as we are sitting here and we are going through draft statements and we have advised our principals to communicate. So probably by day tomorrow, depending on the stage of readiness, there will be the communication. But there's also engagement with ESCOM, as you said. Not even when we operate and we leave ESCOM, we become one. We actually will say maybe they need either to move from Edward Park to DPA or to the union building or move there. Because it's really that kind of engagement that you talk to ESCOM on every day. You can't separate us from ESCOM, and it's because we realize the seriousness of the situation. But I think also it's the point of we've learned with this that the sooner we embed the department's mandate, the clearer, the better. And 2008, we thought we were in trouble. But now we realize that we had good plans there, but we did not implement them efficiently and effectively. And so we don't want to repeat the same mistakes. And I think all the sessions and engagement with the committee today gave me a level, good level of comfort that our strategy is not actually on the right track. And if we can implement this strategy that way and lead to those commitments, we would set the path for not only the state-owned companies in our portfolio, but for other state-owned companies. And also because Kenya has given us that mandate to say, don't even look at your own portfolio. Look for all the two entities. So that for once and for all, we create a consistent platform for all state-owned companies. So I think we have a duty and we are up to the task to perform that task. So, Chair, I took a decision that vandaag ik kan bij een korte bonda hier. So I would allow my colleagues to korte bonda.
Thank you. I was going to respond to the question that was asked around the funding options. The funding options, I was just trying to summarize, but we do have a high level funding option that is actually identified in terms of the SOCs that they can achieve results, both from the public sector side and the private sector side. We do have a exhaustive one, which also looks at even the domestic funding partners that we've actually identified, as for example the DSA part that we've actually looked at. In terms of the sustainability of those, I should probably indicate that in terms of our SOCs, from the funding perspective, neither ESCOM nor Transnet had, a failed bond option ever since they've actually undertaken the BOLD program. So we continue to monitor and actively ensure that it actually does happen in a proper way that actually get involved in the whole process of capital raising in order to reduce the reliance on the success. And also in terms of the other areas that we actually look at the SEP such as equity partners, that must be realistic and it must also be making a differentiation between the operational issues and also the strategic equity partners, and have to make a diagnosis as to what is actually available and what is the most optimal partner that will actually address the issue
attend. So that is what I would like to probably indicate. But we do have a whole host of funding options. Not only are we looking at private sector, but we're also looking at the public sector in terms of the funding options.
Let me respond to the question from Honorable Rando on national impact. The comment was made in the context of the social compact concluded by SAFO dealing with communities around their plantation. Of course, on our side as a department, we want them to have a national impact. We believe that SAFCO is a solar product is a strategic national resource. With the way things are going in the industry, we're going to remain as on a few companies that are still producing pine on a 30-year rotation. And this is a clear pine which is very suitable for furniture manufacturing. If you look at the amount of furniture that we are bringing to the country, we have done studies with Deloitte, which has shown the opportunity that is there if ourselves and DDI to work together to ensure that some of that furniture is produced in this country. And we do have the skills still in this country to produce the quality furniture that can be produced from this particular soil. In the role that we have defined for the there are commercial forests in Duff. Some of these forests are located in the Eastern Cape as well in southern KwaZulu-Natal. The expertise that SAFCOL has can be utilized to rehabilitate these particular forests and to ensure a greater economic impact in those regions where these forests are located. That's what we want from SAFCOL. And whether we'll achieve it as bureaucrats and where we are looking at their plans, it's something that going forward we have to work together to see whether it is indeed awesome. That's definitely what I want to say, because we do look at SAFCOL's performance in relation to its competitors or similar organizations locally, and we believe there's a huge room for improvement. Ensuring the national impact that we all like to see.
So are you also impacted by the legislation in SAFCOL's work?
Unfortunately, the way the shareholder model is structured, being very reliant on, and I'm turning it as an engineer, the lawyers on the team are best positioned to talk, is that for us to intervene, we have to intervene through the minister, we have to intervene through the board to ensure the executives are doing what we expect them to do. Now, that unfortunately has proven to be quite a challenge. So we are hoping that our legal colleagues with the model that they are now developing, which hopefully will be legislation soon, that myself as the DDG, I'll be in a position to work in and ensure certain things are done. So that's what I've been tasked with. That's what the minister tells me to do. But unfortunately, I do not have that direct role and impact in the organization.
Yeah, let's try to speed up the time is on our side.
Chair, in response to Honorable Ransom's question about the timeline post on the white paper. As I said in my earlier response, our project plan is really aggressive and very ambitious. But while I didn't allude to it, the fact that we've got like phases, we've got phase one, phase two, phase three. And phase one really is all about the consultations that I alluded to earlier. We are in the phase where we talk to other departments. And also the given the contract resolution to the IMC, that it must look at holistically at other SOC that are not necessarily falling under DPE. For example, there's the Central Energy Fund, there's PASA, there's
GCAEER, all those, and it's in terms of the post office strengthening the oversight function over all those SOT. So the phase one, it might, like I said, the project plan that you'll admit or you will really adjust to the fact that it's really a plan, and the desire of the department should stick to the plan. But there are variables, there are dependables in this consultation. So we're really hoping to stick the plan that we swiftly move to phase two, which is now legislative process. Which is like from February 2016 onwards. So we really ambitious in terms of sticking to our plan.
Thank you.
Now, I do understand the plan is so aggressive. Or maybe it's because you're not involved in these processes. And when you talk about next year, February, that's when you'll be starting the process of legislation. And with all these challenges we have as a country, like in ESCOM, any other, and is there any new way of shortening all these processes? Because we are in April now, and we still have 8 more months to go. Does this mean we'll take 8 months to complete the consultation processes?
Thank you, Chair. Actually, let me talk to that point. What the next year date talks to is having, because either way you still have to go through the process of a legislative program where it will come to the committees and you must consult and do all those other things. But in the meantime, there are activities that we do. For example, we have already started working on give the minister the powers based on the Companies Act. And we've also, for example, around the ESCOM, had a meeting with the ESCOM board where we said, what is business unusual? Our intervention should not be based on legal prescripts. So the board understands that now we're reaching directly, there's no, sometimes we won't follow the governance in terms of decisions that the board should make through the minister. So minister can just write it to the board. And directly, and the board will have to ensure that they don't go through a lengthy process of consulting internally through their various parties for a particular approval to be given. A typical example is the signing of the caution on the 31st. What we did was that it was a meeting between the two ministers and a decision was taken, and then we communicated with NERSA, and the following day has consigned the agreement with the co-generators. So even if we have this process, we've already introduced measures that we can intervene immediately and have things happen, and then we can just bring a killing through the war room and the president directly or the deputy president directly instead of following a protracted process. So those are already happening while the development of the legislation is taking place.
Okay, if there are no comments or questions, I think we can allow the department to leave, and then we will remain and have a way forward in what we have discussed and the AG's input as well. Thank you very much, official from the department. We wish you well in this endeavor to make sure we keep lights in our country and creation of jobs and growing our economy as well. And you must always bear in your mind thousands and millions of South Africans are looking upon you. If the meeting is yet over, I'm just rounding up to say millions of South Africans are looking upon you to bring solutions. And it is upon yourself to make sure that you are real public servants like we are. We have taken an oath that we will serve the people of South Africa, and we must indeed do that. Challenges will always be there, but let's bear in our minds at the forefront of whatever we are doing. People must come first. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's all.
Honourable members, before we go to the minutes, I would just want us to have a way forward. Next week, I'm told if you have a, remember we agreed that we want to meet the board, the Eskom board, the new board, before the chairperson was even fired. Now the chairperson is fired before we can even meet with them. Now we need to have an approach because in my view, it shouldn't be like one of those meetings without anything concretely achieved out of the discussions. So I just want us to have a focused approach to say, what are the issues? Yes, we know the current crisis of load shedding and whatever will be in the agenda, but also there's a whole range of issues which relate to what we're experiencing now. Governance issues, administration, and so on and so on. So let's just have the researchers to go deep to this past 2 months in Eskom to go and ask what are other issues over and above what we already know in Eskom.
Can I make a suggestion that perhaps we submit questions to the board and we say these are the questions that we want answered to, because we might be asking some questions that require them to do some investigation. And that way we don't have a situation where they come here and they say, well, look, we don't have the answer now, but we'll send it to you. You know, a la SAA, which they never do. So perhaps if we are extremely organized and disciplined and we send our questions to DSUN, but let's say Friday, and DSUN sends them to the board, then the board can prepare the answers. And that way we save time even when they're here. We actually get more time to listen to them, answer our questions, than us ask the questions and then they have to answer. That could be a possibility.
That's a suggestion. Are you seconding the suggestion or you are coming up with an alternative? Let me give Honourable Member first. Honourable Rachel?
Yes. I am not with the suggestion. I am against the suggestion because some of the things that we need to ask are things that they are going to present to us on that day. And you know, Chairperson, I am not sure, man. You know, some of these entities, they're not realistic. They're not honest. Let me say that. If we give them questions in advance, it means we are saying to them they must prepare a very good presentation for us. And that might come back and hit us there. Let them come and give us the presentation. And we pose questions to them as they are in front of us. I'm afraid of a situation where they will come with a very shiny presentation in front of us because we have given them a question in advance.
Honourable Mares.
Chairperson, I just turn to support what Dr. Chef said because we will have the opportunity to ask follow-up questions on the presentations they will do, and we will be prepared with follow-up questions. It's just for them that maybe certain critical things that we want them to address when they come here. So even if it's like only 5 questions we sent them advance, we will still go through their motions and ask our follow-up questions as they are seeing that. Is there any precaution in advance to make sure that we address certain specific issues?
It's the kind of governance issues. We have two suggestions, the one of forwarding them questions in advance and the one of saying no, we interrogate them here. But I'm going to suggest, because we have our researchers here, if we send them questions, we also send the copies to them to go and see what are the questions we'll ask them, so that they can also go and do the research around those questions. And also on other issues which maybe we might not be aware of. That will be my proposal.
I agree with it completely, that we don't want them to come in with crystallized, pretty versions. What I meant was that they're going to come in the presentation and they might leave things out, like their KPIs and how they achieve their KPIs and their employment equity, because that's what they did last time. But if we say to them, we specifically want, when you come here, we want you in your presentation, the following things must be in the presentation, like we want the full maintenance plan. That they can't give up on the spot. But if you tell them we want your full maintenance plan, they'll have to bring them here. And then we can interrogate after that as well. But the questions are just to make sure they don't have an excuse to leave certain things out which they've done in the past.
No, it's fine. Let's do it in that way. And secondly, the energy.
Thanks, Jefferson. I think what the honourable members here, I think, is quite correct to enable the board to come with the relevant answers. But that has actually taught us lessons that are not beneficial to our cause. You know, we don't want artificial kind of responses. This board, they know exactly what is their mandate. And it is not our duty that they know when they come there what is it that they must talk to. They must talk to their own establishment. Why is it necessary for them to be regarded as the people who will be answerable to the issues that relate to ESCOM? We know it for a fact. These questions that have been sent either to ministers or anyone else, definitely our bureaucrats will always find ways of responding. They will never be quiet. But there is nothing wrong in us, chairperson, declaring a board or declaring a department dysfunctional at this level without opening up a notion of saying, no, they have an answer. But that answer is not satisfactory. So to say come with this, what if they say, no, we are still you. We can't respond to these issues. We'll respond when we are giving an annual report. This meeting is not an ordinary meeting that we want with them. It's a meeting that we want to understand so that we can be at a position of saying how ESCOM is at the So we have an ESCOM, we have a board now that is actually going to run with the board. But now, it's that now we want to be part, we don't want to be co-opted to those problems that they have if they are not telling us. Because they must be very honest and be frank to us in order for us to assist them and advise them.
Let's hear the researchers. Rodney? Read the solution here.
Okay. No, I don't think I've offered a solution. I think what works best, Chair, meetings, because we know that there are issues relating to governance, issues relating to financial, issues relating to operational and the built environment, you know, the maintenance. So those things maybe could be supplemented by questions, but those are the high-level things that are challenging the entity. And then there are two processes, the five-point plan that has been decided by the ministers of economic clusters. How far is the progress on that plan? I think it's important because as much as they are health current situation, they also have, and then there's war room process also that is headed by the Deputy Minister of Energy. Well, how far is it? So those things are broad enough. The issues relating to labor, issues at Mwetopi, and then the load and the state of the grid could also be captured in the operational issues. But I think it's important to understand the legislative, the high-level issues that have been coming from cabinet, and then flag everything in terms of things that really respond. Because also, as much as they have a direct accountability to us, we also have a direct accountability to the minister. So the minister must also offer leadership as a shareholder in terms of that meeting. And then the department, the responsible units leading to ESCOM has to also offer. And so from our side, I think we don't have a problem with any approach that is taken. But I think we must not also forget the long term, as much as there are critical challenges now in terms of what they want to achieve, so that we will broaden it in terms of the things that are supposed to be taken. So I don't know if it helps or confuses.
Link?
All I want to say is that by this afternoon you'll probably get my brief already on ESCOM, because I've been working on it already, and it does address the maintenance issues, the financial instability, which includes the tariff increases and the debt for the municipalities, and then the board instability, which has obviously been in the newspaper now, and then the uncertainty with regards to the legislation regarding energy and electricity, and then some coal issues. ESCOM is saying that they're not going to have enough coal going forward. And then the bowl program, obviously, with some Doopy strikes and everything. And then also keeping up the war room and what the progress is, because nobody really knows what's going on in the war room. Yeah, so that is the issues that I brought up in my brief. I can send this afternoon, and if anybody wants any further information, you can just send me an email and I'll just do more. Yeah, I'll just do more up on that issue.
I think she has covered most of the things. She just, wrote to send them. Did we invite the minister in that meeting? No, the board only.
When is it?
Yes, and the energy committee was also requested to be part of that meeting. I don't know if ministers will be ready, or should just send the invitation to them. Yeah, I think let's extend the invitation, because we need to interrogate these issues. And the principals will be there as well. We will really appreciate both the two ministers.
Okay.
Let's proceed with we have this way forward. We'll invite the two ministers, and then we'll have the questions to ESCOM board, and then according to the things that they suggested and what they has already done. Our minutes of the 25th, of the 18th of March, the 18th of March, where we get a briefing on the progress made to address the findings of the AG, and then we also have to consider the adoption of that minute, and then the oversight report, as well as the first term program amendment are amended. On page one, honorable members, do we have any corrections to make? Page two. 3. Page 4. On page 5, I would like us to, on page 6, I would like us to pay a specific attention to our resolutions. This is what we resolved in the last meeting. And then we agree that the minister should also come and brief the committee. Yeah, I think in this meeting we are proposing next week, this will be the opportunity maybe to deal with some of these issues here. Anything else for the minister? Thank you very much. The meeting is adjourned. We will meet. Hello, Mary, are you seconding? Are you proposing? Any seconder? Dr. Lienge, thank you. Then the second says before we say. The second date is for the 25th of March. Page 1. 2. Page 3. Page 4. And 5. Also the resolution. The committee resolved that it will convene another meeting in the second term of deliberate with the Department of Public Enterprises on the strategic plan in order to develop a deeper understanding and ensure that it is in line with the national outcomes. The committee also resolved that there was a need for more regular interactions with the Minister of Public Enterprises in order to get an update on policy matters and enhance the oversight role of the committee. We have done that today, and Honorable Seconder? Honorable Yeager, seconded. Thank you very much. You want to say something again? Okay.
I just want to know something. This is not a serious concern, but you see on the parliamentary program that you see that Monday the 27th of April is public holiday, and Friday the 1st of May is also a public holiday. So there's three working days in between the 5th of Wednesday and Thursday, but there's a plenary on the Tuesday, a joint plenary, but not as further scheduled like for the Wednesday, maybe our committee meeting on the Thursday. But I've seen on the program that it indicated proposed and maybe could be changed. I just note that we take cognizance of that.
No, sir. Okay. Thank you very much. The mission is adjourned. We'll meet next week. We just hope this is not anything. In this winter time. Oh, sweet time.